I'll show you. I'll make a bouquet every week for a year and use only what's in my own garden or what I can source from my local flower farmers and prove you're wrong.
This is the Living Homegrown Podcast, episode number 41.
These bouquets forced me to turn off the computer, to turn off the phone, to go out on the porch. And it was like a meditative process that really changed my life to slow down.
Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast, where it's all about how to live farm fresh without the farm. To help guide the way to a more flavorful and sustainable lifestyle is your host, national PBS TV producer and canning expert, Teresa Lowe.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome to episode number 41 of the Living Homegrown Podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Lowe, and this podcast is where we talk about living farm fresh without the farm. And that's through artisan food crafts like canning and fermenting, growing your own organic food, and just living a more sustainable lifestyle. If you'd like to learn about any of these topics or my online canning courses, just visit my website, livinghomegrown.com. You know, I talk a lot on this show about seasonal and local flavor and all the benefits that we get from fresh from the garden flavor and how to preserve it ourselves or even how to grow it ourselves. But today, I'm not going to talk about flavor at all. No, instead, we're going to talk about local flowers and why we should care about where we get our flowers as much as we should care about where our food comes from. There's just so many parallels between the two worlds of food and flowers. And it wasn't until I became very intentional with my own food choices that I even began to consider the question, where do the flowers come from that are in the supermarket? So many of us are working towards eating more seasonally and with locally sourced ingredients, and we're not only enjoying the freshness that comes with that, but we're also trying to make a smaller imprint on the earth with our choices. Well, the same thing can be said for flowers. And I thought that the week before Valentine's Day is the perfect time to talk about this subject. So I'm bringing on my friend today, Deborah Prinzing, to talk about slow flowers and the grassroots movement that's behind it. Deborah and I have been friends for a really long time. She is a very, very accomplished writer and speaker and a leading advocate for American-grown flowers. And I've watched her take this entire journey over the last few years, and I just thought it would be really interesting to you guys to hear how she came from where she was to where she is now in the local flower movement. Through her many slow flower branded projects, she started this whole national conversation that really tries to stimulate both consumers and professionals into making conscious choices about their flower purchases. Now, Deborah is the producer of slowflowers.com, and that's an online directory of American-grown farms, florists, shops, and studios who source domestic and local flowers. And we'll talk about that a little bit in this episode. But she's also a podcaster, and her podcast is also called Slow Flowers, and I will have a link to that in the show notes. And she is also an incredible writer with 10 books under her belt, including a book called Slow Flowers and another book that I love called The 50 Mile Bouquet. Now, we actually filmed an episode all about The 50 Mile Bouquet for our show on PBS, Growing a Greener World. And I will have links to that episode as well as everything that we talk about today in the show notes for this episode. And that will be at livinghomegrown.com/41. So after you listen to the episode, you can go there to get all of that information. Now, in this episode, Deborah explains how she came to understand the plight of the American flower farmer, but also we talk a lot about the benefits of local seasonal flowers and how we as consumers can make a difference. I remember reading somewhere that Deborah wrote that just as local food provides a regional taste, so too can flowers, and those flowers kind of share a sense of the place and the season in which they're grown. And just as a chef interprets local flavor, so too can a florist interpret the flowers grown to a particular area. And I just love that. And I think the best part is that with Deborah's help, we can all make those same interpretations of what we grow or what we find locally in our own neighborhoods. So without further ado, let me share with you my interview with Deborah Prinzing of slowflowers.com. Hey, Deborah, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Teresa. Great to talk to you.
You know, you and I have known each other for a really, really long time. And for the last few years, I've watched you on this incredible journey. And I've watched you take this little seed of an idea and shape it into first articles and then your book and now this entire movement and this cause. And I just think it's really awesome. And what I'd like you to do is kind of tell everybody exactly what Slow Flowers are.
You bet. Slow Flowers is sort of a shorthand for describing this whole idea of living consciously and meaningful with sort of meaningful intent about the way we consume flowers. And I know that seems a little frivolous, but we're doing that with the food in our lives. And there's a lot of parallels between flowers and food. So I coined the phrase Slow Flowers as just a way to explain to people what I was involved in, which was promoting American-grown flowers, supporting and promoting family farms that are growing flowers and making a living from that, and then also the floral design community that's starting to shift and become more eco-minded. So sometimes I would just say, you know, it's like slow food, but it's slow flowers. And most people who are foodies or in the culinary world know what slow food is. It's this idea of being mindful and also thinking about the practices used to grow and produce what we consume, being, you know, perhaps more gentle on the earth, and even the whole issue of carbon footprint and the transportation footprint of getting a product from a farm to a consumer. That's all kind of embodied in Slow Flowers.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. We kind of get what slow food is, or locally sourced food, and all the benefits from that. The in season tastes better, it's fresh. So transitioning that to slow flowers makes perfect sense. At least it did to me when I first heard you say that. I was like, oh yeah, I totally get what you're saying.
Well, the funny thing is gardeners are already doing this, you know, and you and I can make, you know, I had a book prior to Slow Flowers called The 50 Mile Bouquet. And that was sort of a play on the very popular book called The 100 Mile Diet, which did explore all of these ideas of how far does our food travel to us or the ingredients we're using. You know, this became a joke to say, well, I'm going to have the 5-step bouquet because I'm going to walk out my back door and clip from my garden. And so gardeners already are doing this, which is really great. They know what the season is. They know the life cycle of a flowering plant or an interesting branch or pod or bud, and they're bringing that indoors to enjoy. That's, you can't get slower than that.
Exactly. Well, I think the journey of how you got here is really interesting. So take us back a little bit. Tell us how you got into this, what first sparked this idea, and the things that happened along the way.
Oh, absolutely. Well, like you, I've been involved in the garden writing industry and speaking and teaching for a long, long time. And my interest was really focused on design because I come at writing from a design background. I have a degree in textile design. But I also was a business writer for years. And so it's really interesting because I was curious, once I started talking to flower farmers, I was really curious about how they sustained their businesses and how they were able to actually live off their land. And all of a sudden, these two interests of mine have come together, horticulture and entrepreneurism, in trying to capture the stories of interesting people in flower farming. But the very first time it got on my radar was in 2006. And I was scouting gardens for a magazine. And I was in a community north of Seattle called Skagit Valley. There happens to be a lot of agriculture there. Anybody who's been to the big tulip festival in Mount Vernon, Washington knows what it's like.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
And there is a lot of floral production. It's mostly, like I alluded to with the tulip festival, it's mostly bulb production. But I met a few flower farmers who were just trying to grow flowers that they could use organic practices on and they could sell to local florists. And one person was just growing sweet peas. That's all she was doing. It's just sparked curiosity in me because I had never really thought about the industry. and what really happens in this big international global floriculture industry. Then our friend Amy Stewart, who many people may know for having written some fabulous books like Wicked Plants and Wicked Bugs and The Drunken Botanist, back in 2007, she came out with a book called Flower Confidential, which is about the same time that I started interviewing flower farmers. And Amy's book raised a lot of awareness about, you know, just the dirty side of flowers. And so that allowed me to open a lot of doors and pick up where she left off and continue on documenting those stories.
Yeah, that was a huge eye opener for me. That was when I first went, you know, I never thought about where our flowers come from. And so talk a little bit about what you learned from that book and where you're headed here, because I think a lot of people are surprised that you had some statistic about 80%. What is it? 80% of our flowers are actually imported. They're not American grown.
Right. And so for about the last 30 years, due to some policies that lifted tariffs on imported flowers, all of a sudden, South America has become this hotbed for growing mainly roses, but other big crops like carnations and mums. Of course, South American countries are close to the equator, so they have the advantage that maybe a farm in Maine wouldn't have, which is year-round production. But regardless of getting, you know, into the political side of it and the policies, the outcome was that the playing field was completely tilted against American flower farming. That happened in 91. And since then, we've seen a steady change in the decline of American flower farms, the decline in the number of stems produced, especially in certain crops, for example, roses. And the state of Colorado alone used to have like 300 carnation farms. There's no carnation farms in the state of Colorado.
Wow.
So all those imports are cheaper. They're being grown by people who are not enjoying the benefits of fair labor laws like our farmers employ in the U.S. And they're the environmental protections that we are assured of in, you know, from farms in the U.S. are not being applied to farms that are on another continent. So all of those things add up to this glaring, shocking statistic that 20% of the flowers sold in the U.S. are domestically produced, 80% are imported.
And I think the thing that really caught my eye or made me go was the way that everything was grown out of the United States. You know, it's not sustainable. And there's no rules or regulations like what our farmers might be trying to do. And so the environmental impact was what made me go, wow.
Right. And to be fair, now because of demand, you know, for organics, there are some corporate farms in countries like Colombia and Ecuador have kind of come up with their own branding to say that they're sustainable. And it, perhaps they are, but those flowers still have to come through U.S. Customs in Miami on jumbo jets. And the only thing that U.S. Customs inspects for are pests. And to get a flower through customs, even if it's organic or sustainably grown, it has to be fumigated to kill any pests that are in that box or, you know, case. So to me, it's just ridiculous. There's no guarantee that there's anything that hasn't been treated with some kind of chemical. You know, it's just not the way I don't want to put that on my dining table, or I don't want to give it to my sweetheart.
Or stick your nose in it.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I guess my feeling is imports are never going to go away because there's too much of a big international global industry that is churning out cheap flowers from South America. Mm-hmm. But I think that the pendulum is swinging back to an interest among people who are also sourcing their food seasonally and locally. There's an interest now in other things that they're purchasing that have been grown, and what are those practices?
So when you first started learning about this, then you kind of started down this journey. What happened next after you started hearing and learning and reading Amy Stewart's book and really starting to talk to farmers?
Yeah, well, farmers, I mean, first of all, I'm in love with farmers. And
me
they
too.
Are just, yeah, I mean, they're the rock stars, right? And they are the hardest working people I know. They care about the land. They're plant geeks. They care about heirloom varieties. They care about trying to save their seeds. All the things that we would love to do in our own practices. And, you know, people who like to collect seeds, and farmers are doing that. I got really fortunate because Washington State, where I live, is the second highest flower producing state in the country after California. And so there is a really strong community here. And I just embedded myself in this community of flower farmers. And what really pivoted the whole conversation and became a professional focus for me is a group of farmers I got involved in who formed their own producers cooperative. It was formed about 5 years ago, called the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market. And they changed the conversation. The farmers said, we're not going to compete on price. We're going to compete on seasonality, on quality, on uniqueness, freshness, and appeal to the design savvy floral community who wants the unusual, ephemeral, delicate bloom that probably couldn't be shipped from South America, which has been their distinctive, their marketing distinctive, is to have the special goodies, the sweet things that you just crave if you're a floral designer, like a clematis vine,
yeah,
or a sweet pea, or some kind of herb or delicate scabiosa, or I could go on and on, and poppies. There's just things that luckily can't be shipped, and that's that's benefited the U.S. farmers. Mm-hmm. So I have been documenting those farmers for 5 years, and many of them are in the book, The 50 Mile Bouquet, which of course you know about because you came to visit the farm that's on the cover of The 50 Mile Bouquet.
Yes, for Growing a Greener World, we did a whole episode. Yep, it's a great story. Right. I'll be sure to link to that in the show notes.
You should, and people can meet Diane and Dennis, the amazing farmers who really started that whole market in the Seattle area. So it's just a really exciting time to be in flower farming because, as I said, the pendulum has swung and the numbers are going back up of people growing cut flowers in the U.S. So, that's, to me, I take that as a indication of the change in consumers' demand because these farmers aren't going to be able to grow flowers if there's not a customer to buy them.
Yep, exactly. So now you've been diving into the whole topic and tell everybody about the first book that you did. You've written several books, but this first book that you did on this topic, The 50 Mile Bouquet, because it's an absolutely gorgeous book and it so draws you into the story of the farmer. And I would love for you to tell everybody how that book came about.
Sure. Well, I'm a journalist. I learn by interviewing people and I had all these wonderful conversations that I had documented. And I was working with David Perry, who's a fantastic photographer. He's also here based in Seattle. And we started teaming up to grab these stories. We really didn't have a publisher. We didn't have a concept. We just knew that we wanted to gather these stories. And so whenever either one of us was traveling, we'd try to meet a farmer and get the story. And if David was there, he'd do the photography. If I was there, I'd do the interview and we'd circle back and try to make it whole. And then together we realized that there was a chance to do a documentary style book that really led people through this path of growing flowers, designing flowers, and kind of the DIY component that was taking place, which is blown up, of people wanting to learn how to do floral design themselves. That is the 50 Mile Bouquet, and it really was sort of an homage to this renaissance that we're seeing. And that book came out in 2012. It's mostly stories of people that I'm still in touch with who are still in the, actively growing flowers, and they've all been models for the rest of the community, for people to look at, wow, you have 2 acres, you can support a family if you work really hard and, create a market for your flowers and live off your land. And that's the aspiration for many people, not to have 500 acres, but just a small family farm.
I think also what really came through for me in that book was the benefits that we as consumers get from buying locally sourced seasonal flowers, because it's so many of the same things that are true for locally sourced food. The freshness, the low carbon footprint, the environmental impact, the low environmental impact, but also giving back to the community. I think that's what really came through in that book. It when you see the farmers, the stories of the farmers and what they're doing, it really made me want to take that extra step to make sure that I try to always purchase something local.
That's great. And I have a big grin on my face listening to you, Teresa. You've basically said my manifesto. I mean, people are afraid to give me flowers now, including my poor husband, because I'm always going to ask who grew these flowers, where were they grown, and what practices were used. And that invisibility of the flower farmer is something that we've also seen in food, where there's this disconnect with the producer, the rancher or the grower or the orchardist. We only, you know, with only in the last couple of decades have we started to put a face on that food. And I think it's inspiring to put a face on that flower farmer.
Yes. You even, in one of your videos, I think it was a promotional video for your book, for your other book, Slow Flowers, but you went out and were handing people a bouquet out on the street and saying, do you know where these flowers came from? And nobody, you know, it's a question you never think about. It's kind of like the way we used to eat our food. We never mm-hmm. thought about where that apple came from, but more mm-hmm. and more people are thinking about that now. And I thought that was Absolutely. So brilliant because I had never thought of it either. You know, here I was going down this path of local food, but I hadn't really thought about the flowers. You kind of just assume that they're, you know, I live in California. I always figured they came from here and never thought to ask.
Absolutely. I mean, I say to people in California, there is no excuse to import flowers. You live in the flower basket of the country.
Yes.
There are flowers 12 months of the year in California.
Yes.
But you know, there have been some surveys, some national surveys funded by the California Cut Flower Commission, asking people, do you know where your flowers come from? And that number has gradually declined from like 80% down to 72%, what still a ridiculously high number of people who don't know. But there is a little bit of a creep to more awareness, which is great. And the follow-up question was, if you were given a choice to buy American-grown flowers, would you? And that number has also increased from about 50% to 59% in the last 5 years. So I think, honestly, giving people a choice is all I'm asking for. And that the biggest culprits are the supermarkets who don't label the source of flowers, whereas every piece of fruit or vegetable has a sticker that says where it was produced. That's not happening on flowers. So people just don't know. And you exactly. can't blame people if they don't know.
Exactly. Yes. I love the book that came out after the 50 Mile Bouquet. So tell everybody about your Slow Flowers book, because it started as a challenge that you had given yourself.
Well, absolutely. You know, I think that I never considered myself a designer, but once you get in a life of flowers, you can't help but want to put colors together and textures together, and very similar to how I would garden, but I just never connected the dots and thought, oh, I can do this. I can be a florist, obviously just for my own enjoyment. But I started creating seasonal bouquets, and it really was a challenge because I was rejected by an editor when we were trying to sell the 50 Mile Bouquet, which was eventually published by St. Lin's Press. I had a New York editor say to me, you know, that's fine if you live in Santa Barbara, you can have flowers year round, but this isn't relevant for anybody else in the country. And of course she was in New York City, and I thought, you're wrong. Yeah. I thought, I'll make a bouquet every week for a year and use only what's in my own garden or what I can source from my local flower farmers and prove you're wrong. And so it really was just a kind of a knee-jerk response to being rejected. It turned into the most beautiful thing I could have ever done for my own enrichment. And that was taking a day every week to observe my own garden, walk through it year round in the pouring rain, in, you know, the fog, in the hot, hot sun, even, you know, a few times we had snow in Seattle, but to try to observe nature and see what there was of beauty that could maybe be assembled into a bouquet. I did, of course, I'm very fortunate because I'm so associated with this growers market that I was able to go, it was only 3 miles from my house. I could go once a week and also purchase from farmers. These bouquets forced me to turn off the computer, to turn off the phone, to go out on the porch and spend time choosing a vase and assembling my arrangement and then taking a photograph of it. It was like a meditative process that really changed my life to slow down because I'm so connected like everybody is.
Yeah, I love that. You said one of the things you said was it taught you to live life in the slow lane a little bit because you're very much like me. You're go, go, go. Do you have a lot of things going on? And I thought that is so beautiful because it did. It made you kind of, like you said, meditative. It was very personally enriching.
I'm sure that's what happens when you're in the kitchen by yourself and you're making some amazing chutney or something. Like no one's talking to you.
Right. You're just absorbing the smells and the fragrances and the tastes. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So those images were gathered, and I was talking with Paul Kelly, who's the publisher of St. Lin's Press, and he had kind of been teasing me, saying, okay, 50 Mile Bouquet is out. What are you going to do next? And I told him about this project. I thought it was maybe just going to be a blog. And he said, this is great. Let's turn it into a book. And at the time, it was 2011, I thought in my mind that I was going to call it 52 Weeks of Local Flowers. And Paul put a stop to that immediately. He said, that sounds like a 1980s self-help book. not a sexy title. And that's when I said, well, I don't know. What about Slow Flowers? And he's like, boom, that's it. That's what we're going to call
it. Yeah, it's a great title. Yeah,
it is. So that book came out in 2013. It's just a tiny little gift book. There's not a lot of text, but on every arrangement, I gave the entire recipe, all botanical Latin names and common names. I identified every single farm that provided a flower or identified whether it was from my garden or a friend's garden. And then I had a design tip or a tip from the farmer, something that was a lesson. And so they're not step-by-step how-to photos, but it's enough for anybody to go, oh, well, I can do that because I can grow a lilac or I can grow oak leaf hydrangea or, you know, whatever you might have in a garden is up for grabs in the vase as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. I love the winter ones because you had to get very creative and think outside the garden box, I guess. Mm-hmm. You had to think outside the box, and the twigs and the evergreens and the different things that you put together, they were still beautiful, but very seasonal. And as a foodie who loves the seasons, and I also, you know, love to pick things from my own garden, and I always have something on my kitchen table, it really, really shows the seasons, and you get to live in the moment of the seasons just like you can with food. And what I would love to have you do is kind of educate us on some of the ways that we as consumers can make a little bit of a difference. We have Valentine's Day coming up, so, you know, flowers are going to be on everybody's mind. What are some things that we can do when we go to purchase flowers?
Oh, absolutely. And that is a challenge because Valentine's Day is obviously in the winter in most parts of the country. It's also traditionally been considered a rose-giving holiday. The good news is that tulips have almost surpassed roses in popularity at Valentine's Day in the mass marketplace. And tulips are being grown in greenhouses all over the country. So it's very easy to get American-grown tulips that are really beautiful and probably less expensive than a long-stemmed South American rose by the dozens that, you know, get really, there's a big spike in price at Valentine's Day just to take advantage of that demand. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's so many things you can do to make a special floral gift. In the winter, some of the things that I talk about in the Slow Flowers book and I just do in my own practices, I love forcing amaryllis and paper white narcissus bulbs indoors. And those can be cut and used as floral arrangements in a vase, or they can be given on the bulb, which a lot of people find fascinating to see pebbles and the bulbs and the roots all part of the gift that you're giving. Orchids are a huge part of the winter floral palette because they are grown in greenhouses. And like some of these other flowers I alluded to, orchids cannot be shipped. So they are almost exclusively domestically grown. Potted houseplants. I love seeing people use interesting vessels and put a little African violet or a little cyclamen in a old grandma's teapot or teacup, you know, and using that as an alternative. It's more personal.
And it lasts longer. It lasts longer than cut roses would.
Absolutely. Depending on where you live, you possibly can cut some branches from fruit trees or winter ornamental shrubs and force them indoors as well. Well, you have in your orchard, while you're pruning, I'm sure you're not throwing those branches away.
No, I have a big, it's funny you said that. I have a big bouquet right now that I packed in my suitcase from when I was up north pruning all the plum trees, and they're just getting ready to open up. So I'm going to have a big bouquet here of plum branches that are forced, and they're beautiful and they smell good.
Yeah. There's because I have this website now, featuring florists and flower farmers across the country, I'm always intrigued to hear what people are doing on this site, slowflowers.com. And I have a florist member who's in St. Paul, Minnesota. Her business is called Foxglove Marketplace, and her name is Christine Hoffman. And she does something so innovative last year. She is committed to only using Minnesota-grown product year-round. All she really had access to at Valentine's Day were pussy willows. And she did an entire campaign in her marketplace called Show Your Love with Local. And she actually sold out of Pussy Willow bouquets at Valentine's Day.
Wow.
And it was so, I'm like, great. You know, the guys who've been watching the Super Bowl ads and seeing them, you know, the big Valentine's Day, you know, 800 XYZ, you know, promotions to spend hundreds on roses. They were being told that this was a loving thing to do. And she had all those men coming in and buying Pussy Willow bouquets. I loved it.
That's so cute. Really cute. Well, and I'm glad you mentioned slowflowers.com because that's a place we can go to see if there's any florists in our area that are doing this sort of thing. Isn't that right?
Yes. And slowflowers.com is a free resource for any of your listeners. Anybody can go on and search for a farmer or florist shop or studio who sources American grown flowers. And there are a lot of farmers who do sell direct to people in their marketplace, the DIY crowd, or maybe you want to buy flowers and try arranging yourself. They'll sell you a bucket. In fact, I think last year there was somebody who, a woman who has a farm in Nebraska, and again, her ground was covered in snow. She created CSA gift cards to sell at Valentine's Day. And some of her customers gave the gift card for flowers later in the season when she had perennials and dahlias exploding in her field. So there's some really clever things you can do. But this site has over 650 members in, I think, 48 states. We've got a few states that we're still recruiting in. And you can just type in your zip code, your city or state, and or a keyword like a particular flower, and you'll find a list then of what's in that area that you can perhaps order direct or email or call and ask them to help you. And they all want to help you because they want to be transparent with consumers about where those flowers are coming from.
Yeah. And I think also if, for instance, you don't have anything in your area, then I think absolutely ask your local florist because they may be doing that on a small scale. And if you just want to know, like you, maybe you don't know what's in season, they're the expert. You can go in and ask them, you know, is there anything that you are selling here that you have that's locally sourced? And
right.
If there's a demand for it, they'll get it. And I think more and more florists are trying to do that, but people just don't ask.
Absolutely. And if the florist tells you that they can't get local or American grown, you tell them to call me.
Yeah.
And I might just mention that this sort of local movement has kind of segued into the American grown movement because we do have so many parts of the country that are covered in snow in the winter. It is not realistic, truly, for many of those areas to have a lot of product. They might have some greenhouse product, but there's an energy cost to greenhouses. So, you know, you see all kinds of facets coming into play on those flowers and how they're produced. But the American grown option is pretty much buying for those florists to buy from Florida, California, Oregon, Hawaii during the colder months. And I advocate if you can't get local flowers, at least make sure they're American grown because you're still supporting an American flower farm then.
Yes.
And, you know, yes, there's a bit of a carbon footprint, but it's a shorter distance than something from another continent. There are people on the Soulflower site. There's a handful of people you can search by national shipping. And there are some people, especially on the West Coast, who are shipping beautiful, beautiful flowers, you know, overnight to a recipient anywhere in the country. And you know that they're locally, you know, they're locally grown in California and they're picked one day and shipped to you the next. So they're
right.
Super fresh.
So they're super fresh and they're still American grown. So that's awesome. Well, I think these are all excellent tips. And another thing I wanted to touch on with you was, you know, so many of us have heard or are participating in farm to table events, you know, where the meal is prepared, local ingredients, a local chef, a local venue. And I have loved what you have been doing with it. You've kind of done and been working with people doing this floral extension of that, and it's called field to vase events. So
yes.
I would love for you to talk a little bit about that because you guys just came out with your schedule for all the field to vase events that are coming up. So tell everybody what that is.
Sure. Slow Flowers partnered with a brand new program. It's 2 years old, called Certified American Grown. And Certified American Grown is a branding, like a Good Housekeeping seal of approval type of thing, a branding for American flowers. It's often large farms, but I know a lot of small farms who are involved, and it gives them a third party labeling program to put on their flowers when they're selling them. Because as I alluded to earlier, supermarkets aren't labeling flowers. So now the farmers are saying, fine, we'll label them ourselves. So I partner with that program. There's about 50 or 60 farms that are certified, and we decided to use that farm-to-table dinner model to get people on American Flower Farms, enjoy an evening, and learn about this issue. And the motto is, we want the flowers at the center of your table to be as local as the food on your plate. And it's been phenomenal, Teresa. In fact, I know I invited you to a couple of these, and I've got to get you to one.
I know.
In 2016.
Well, I am absolutely going to go to one in this coming year, because I've so wanted to go. And as you know, I wasn't able to, but I so wanted to go. And the photographs, I'll be sure to link to this also in the
Absolutely.
Show notes, because the photographs are just incredible. And you can just imagine the incredible evening that you guys had. They're beautiful tables, everything from the food to the flowers on the table being all locally sourced and fresh and fresh picked. And it's just, looked like so much fun.
And it is fun, and I'm going to be involved again this year. And what is exciting is that it's just convening a conversation. And a lot of foodies who have never thought about their flowers are enticed because they love that dining experience. They want to be on a farm. And a lot of the chefs that we've been partnering with, they're being really supportive of the flower part of the agriculture and culinary story. So they're putting edible flowers into their dishes. It's a lot of fun. But even if you can't go to one of the dinners, you can feast your eyes on the photos, and the links that you will provide will kind of get people thinking about even asking their own flower farmer in their own community if they can have a dinner there.
Yeah. Well, and if you're having a wedding or an event, absolutely look at these photos, because it'll give you all kinds of ideas. And they do have these all over the country, right? They're not just in your area.
In 2015, they went everywhere from California, Oregon, Washington, Boulder, Colorado, Detroit, Michigan, Washington, D.C., New York City. And the same is happening again this year. We're adding some cool new cities. We're going to be in Bucks County, Virginia. We're going to be back in Brooklyn, but also new farms. So we're getting so many invitations. For example, I really wanted to go to Chicago this year. I think that's going to get bumped out to 2017. But there's 10 dinners. And what we found, Teresa, is that people would say, oh, I'm going to be on vacation in Colorado in August. I don't live there, but I'm going to try to get to that dinner. And so if we make sure you have the link, people can check it out and plan in advance.
Absolutely. I will link to that. And everyone can at least see the photos, even if they can't go. So that'll be fantastic. Well, Deborah, before we finish up, I really would love for you to tell everybody how they could possibly meet you, because I know you have some events coming up. I think the San Francisco Flower and Garden Show is one event where if they're going to be coming, they could meet you in person.
Oh, that would be really fun. Of course, you're going to share all the links for my calendar, so that's another possibility. But the San Francisco Flower and Garden Show has committed to adding a floral stage this year. That show is held March 16th through 20th. It's 5 days of fabulous gardens, but also speakers. Are you going to be speaking there, Teresa?
Not at San Francisco, okay. But I'll be at the Seattle Flower and Garden Show in February.
Another amazing show. And I am going to be part of the floral competition at that show, showcasing locally grown flowers. But San Francisco, if you want to meet some florists who are using local flowers and teaching really cool design techniques, there'll be 20 different presentations over the course of 5 days. And for the cost of going into the show, which I think is probably under $20, you could sit through 5 of those presentations a day, plus hear other garden and cooking instructors. So that's really fun. And I'm committed to, whenever I travel, to meet flower farmers who are doing exciting things. And because I have a podcast too, people can hear those stories if they're interested, because every week I've got a conversation with a flower farmer or a florist who, if you can't travel to, Montana, maybe you'll get to virtually go there if you listen to a podcast or something like that.
Yes. And you always have a post along with that podcast, which is excellent, because you have all the photos of everything that you've been talking about. So I'll be sure to link to that too. There'll be a lot of links in the show notes for this episode. But yes, I love the stories that you tell.
Well, thank you so much. And it's really a fun way to create community when we're also spread out across the country and we're not always near everybody. But I mean, I think that's just the power of any movement, is people are more impactful when they join forces and share ideas to influence the conversation on a bigger scale than just their own backyard.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to everybody about this, because your grassroots efforts have made a difference for so many people. And I know I have learned so much from you and watching you on this whole journey and making it be more of a part of my everyday life, trying to be more local and sourcing not only my food, but now my flowers. So I really appreciate you coming on the show today. Thanks so much.
Oh, it was a blast. Thanks, Teresa.
So that's my interview with Deborah Prinzing of slowflowers.com. I hope you guys got a lot out of that. I really wanted you to be energized about all the possibilities about living seasonally with our flowers, just like we do with our food. Everything being seasonal just is fresher. It supports the local economy, has a lower carbon footprint, and it absolutely fits into living a more sustainable lifestyle. I'm going to have everything that Deborah mentioned, all of the links to all of the different websites that she talked about, in the show notes for this episode. All you have to do is go to livinghomegrown.com/41, and I'll have everything there for you. So until next time, just keep working towards living a little bit more local, seasonal, and homegrown. Catch you next time. Take care.
That's all for this episode of the Living Homegrown Podcast. Visit livinghomegrown.com to download Teresa's free canning resource guide and find more tips on how to live farm fresh without the farm. Be sure to join Teresa Lowe next time on the Living Homegrown Podcast.
Purchasing that have been grown, and what are those practices? I see it happening in other... There's my horn.
Oh, yeah. So that's a fog horn?
It's some kind of maritime horn. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really funny.
Yeah. So you can cut that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fine.